We'll open up the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Workforce Development. We have some members outside, this will bring them in. So we'll open in subcommittee and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 324. Janet, why don't you kind of tell us first what we got here before we start our testimony?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 324 is a bill that reorganizes the real estate agency and converts the real estate board from an advisory to a policymaking body with an oversight role over the agency and the real estate commissioner. The bill in the original form you have it is not in line with the recommendations that were made by the Interim Task Force on Real Estate Agency Oversight. We won't have the final amendments today. We may have them later this week, but we're going ahead with the hearing, so some of the comments on the original bill you may have to hold, and this is the bill is going to align with the recommendations of the task force. You have at your place the two-page executive summary of the interim task force recommendations, and the director of the real estate agency is here, and Senator Johnson and Representative Esquivel were the co-chairs of the task force this interim, and they're here to speak to the recommendations of the task force and how those relate to Senate Bill 324. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Senator Johnson, Representative Esquivel, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16, and along with my esteemed colleague and friend, Representative Esquivel, we were the chairs of the interim task force on the real estate agency. And I think what Representative Esquivel is going to do is to give you a little tiny bit of history that led up to the creation of the task force. I'm going to comment on the task force and the status of the bill language and the amendments that are being drafted, and with that I think we would be available for questions, and that would constitute our testimony.
Okay.
For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. Let's go back a little bit in our memories. We've been in this building as of last session. Senator Metzger, you can remember quite vividly what's really got us here, and that was House Bill 2604. That started the ball rolling in the aspect that we had people from the profession themselves come up and were discussing the inconsistency of discipline. Example, you'd have two people that had the same violation. One individual would get a $4,000 fine while the other individual would get a $100 fine. Very inconsistent. The more we got into this and more we discussed it and talked about it, the more we realized that there was some shortcomings in the system as a whole. This actually came to a conclusion during the budgetary process when we had some real serious concerns in the subcommittee of Ways and Means on this agency. This agency could not even identify how many people work there. There's only 30. So could not identify how many were female, how many were male. Didn't have no idea of how many minorities they had involved. So there's some serious things here. We embarked and had a budgetary note to embark upon an interim committee, which was co-chaired by my esteemed colleague from the Senate, Senator Johnson, and myself. And we had four such committee meetings. We had one in Medford. I believe we had the rest of them were here, weren't they? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We had quite an exhaustive schedule of away meetings, and in the interest of accommodating as many people as possible, we ended up centralizing the meetings here. There was expense involved. We added an additional meeting in lieu of a lot of additional away meetings. The point I think that we're both trying to make is that this bill had a very comprehensive set of hearings with an attempt to take it out to Oregonians where they live and work, as well as to hear concerns and interests here in the building.
And we came to a conclusion, and you've read those conclusions and recommendations, and right now we're in the process of drafting what we actually recommended and to get a package in front of you. Now, having said that, you're going to hear testimony, I'm sure, from a lot of people, from a lot of different aspects of it. You're going to have a lot of push and pull here. But the committee recommendations, I think, are very specific. I think they're very to the point, and I think they're very constructive. So, therefore, I'm going to turn this over to Senator Johnson and let her finish up on where we're at with the amendments at this point.
Thank you very much. One of the reasons that you don't have language in front of you right now is that we have been struggling to try to keep language that is consistent and true to the findings of the task force. And for a variety of reasons, we have struggled to get language that adequately captures the work of the task force. Just to remind all of you, I think the executive summary prepared by the committee staff is excellent, but to put it on the record, the co-chairs were Representative Esquivel and myself. We were joined by Senator Shields, Senator Starr, Representative Ackerman, Representative Thatcher, Representative Smith, Representative Galizio. The commissioner sat both as a member, Scott Taylor, before his departure from the agency, sat as both a member of the task force as well as providing a great deal of testimony to the task force. And then we had public members, Mr. Kegler, Vada Salinas, and Brad Vincent, who all provided, I think, an excellent window into the concerns of the public as the task force received this information. And so what we hope to be able to bring you is a bill language that is consistent with the deliberations of the task force. And, frankly, the drafting has proved to be challenging. At this point in the proceedings, I think there are a lot of people who did not bother, a lot of interests that did not bother to attend the meetings nor provide input to the committee, who now have an interest in it's second-guessing, for lack of a better word, the work of the task force. I think Representative Esquivel and I are here in no small measure to defend the integrity of the work of the task force and to ask you to the best of your ability, once you get language that the committee is able to look at, to try to follow those recommendations. And I understand that this is a process. The legislature is, by definition, a process of negotiation and give and take. But I hope that you would give perhaps extra consideration to those folks who followed the proceedings of the task force and were participatory as we developed our recommendations. The summary is really an excellent summary. I'm not going to read it to you. I would commend it for your review. The principal thing that we're doing is taking a board that had been largely a rubber stamp up to this point and causing them to be a much more activist board, engaging in best business practices of governance and oversight of the agency, with the ability to do more than simply come together and accept the agency's recommendations. This is a board that the task force has charged with using the substantial talent on the board to help guide the direction of the agency, to understand the budget, to review legislative proposals before they come to the building. Our theory is that the board provides the eyes and ears of the public into the agency, and that the public is well served by an activist, engaged, informed board that feels as though they have a genuine role in the governance of the agency. So that is the most substantial policy shift that the agency up to this point had been much more agency-driven, and we caused the board to be much more engaged in the policy deliberations of the agency. So I hope that you'll take the time to read the task force summary. There is a substantial document that I think is a very fair reflection of the deliberations that occurred during the time the task force was convened, and I think we'll give you a very good historical perspective on what it is that the task force attempted to accomplish over a number of meetings throughout the interim. And with that, I think we'd be available for questions if you have any.
Okay. Any questions for our colleague, Senator George?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Senator, thank you very much. The very first recommendation, I just want you guys to give me kind of a little philosophical view. Making the real estate board from an advisory board to a policymaking board, taking that power away from the commissioner and investing it. We deal with this in a number of agencies where we have directors that are more powerful versus the commissions. Kind of from your philosophical perspective, why in this situation is it more important to shift that to a board rather than having direct answers to the governor's office? What's the sort of...
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think what that is, we are not, and I repeat, we are not recommending that this board take care of the day-to-day operation. We are recommending that they have an overall view of the policy, the way this, they're going to be the ones to be the board. and the CEO, of course, will be the commissioner and or director, whatever you want to call it. But they're the ones that are going to establish which way the ship goes, where it goes, how it's going to get there, and then it's up to the CEO to get it there. If you, if my memory serves me correct, unless it's been changed a little bit and I haven't seen the latest edition, that the commissioner will, in fact, answer to the governor. This board will, on a yearly basis, evaluate that commissioner. And I think that's very necessary, because you could sit there for 8 to 10 years, and if you have no evaluations, what do we know what you're doing? This board brings to the table a substantial amount of expertise in the profession itself. That's very, very important. You take a board that has 20 years plus, and there's, say there's 7 of them, well, you can do some mathematics and understand we have a very, very large untapped amount of experience here that we need to utilize in our profession in order to make it better.
If I could really quickly follow up, I guess, how do you envision the rule writing authority going? The rule writing authority would shift away from the commissioner and to the board? Is that...
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the board itself will make recommendations. They will work hand in hand with the commissioner in order to craft legislation for the future itself, for the rule writing, for the policy part of this agency. We need to have some people that, one, understand the profession. It's very difficult for anyone to understand this profession unless you're part of it. I'll be quite candid with you. But more importantly, they need to be involved in the policy-making part of this agency, because they're the ones that are on the day-to-day basis. And even if you have a commissioner that has 20 years' experience, after about 3 to 5 years, they are no longer engaged in what's going on out there where the rubber meets the road. These individuals on this board, it's a daily basis with them. That's what makes it so good, and it makes it an opportunity for us to take that energy and take that professionalism and that experience and instill it into the agency itself. That's how that has to work. They are not responsible for the day-to-day operation. That's up to the commissioner himself or herself.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, if I could take a whack at this too. I think that you would be pleased with the idea of a board that is the eyes of the public being able to give guidance and input to the agency. I think it will result in a rule writing process that is more reflective of citizen concerns rather than the rather autocratic decision of the commissioner and inside staff. This, again, is in no way an attempt to have the board running the agency, but it is an attempt to more thoroughly utilize a very talented board and to have their service to the state be meaningful service. Asking some of these people to come at great distance to ostensibly be rubber stamps, I thought was disrespectful of the caliber of people who are gubernatorial appointees approved by the Senate. And this will give them, I think, substantive role in being able to help guide the agency based on their ability to interact with the profession outside the agency and be able to bring that guidance and public opinion reflection back to the deliberations of the agency.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to go until 1:45 on this bill. I'm just telling you that because I have a lot of people signed up on a bill in which we don't have amendments yet, and so I'm not going to overly do it until we know what we're talking about. But I think you heard from the two task force folks that were looking for amendments that reflect the task force recommendations. And so I would suggest that as people testify, they testify to the issue before us in terms of what we anticipate, whether you think this is good policy, as opposed to the data in the bill, because then we're not talking about that apparently at this moment. So Jeffrey Seymour and Betty Reynolds are the first two signed up. If you want to come forward, tell us what you think about the task force recommendations and whether they're good, bad, and indifferent.
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Betty Reynolds. I'm from West Lynn. I spent my 30-plus year career with regulatory agency. I was director of the Ethics Commission. I was director of the Board of Dentistry. And I spent about 10 years with the real estate agency, retiring in December 2005 as deputy commissioner. I was also active with national regulatory groups, including I was president of the American Association of Dental Administrators, and I was on the board of the National Council of Government Ethics Laws. And I hope to defend my dissertation in public for a PhD in public administration and policy in May. One conclusion that I have reached over the years is that consumer interests aren't adequately protected. They're overshadowed by industry interests.
If I can, and you're not the first, Ms. Reynolds, so please don't take it personally, but we do have your written testimony. I don't want you to read all five pages of
right.
this. As I'm only going to give you a few minutes, as I will everybody else. So
okay.
I do appreciate the written testimony, because that's very helpful as we read this after committee. But if you could speak, summarize orally your major points, that would be really helpful so I can get to as many witnesses in the 25 minutes we're going to devote to this bill.
I oppose Senate Bill 324 because I believe it harms consumers. Although I understand that amendments are going to be proposed as written, it does have the board very deeply involved in controlling the agency. But under current law, the commissioner and seven of the nine board members must be brokers. So in my opinion, it gives too much influence to the industry, to the detriment of consumers. And some background to show how the industry influence can harm consumers is Senate Bill 2604. Even though it's portrayed as something that streamlined the real estate laws, it weakened the laws. For example, the old law had tough false advertising standards, but they're now they have to be reckless material and published by the broker. And I've heard brokers say that, well, I don't publish, newspapers do, therefore I can't possibly engage in false advertising. The old law prohibited negligence, and it was deleted in the new law. The old law said, or under the old law and practice, brokers were responsible for identifying red flags or defects in property. The new law says that the broker isn't required to investigate the condition of property. It also has weakened investigations. Complainants must now show reasonable cause to believe a violation occurred, and that puts a big burden on consumers to prove their case or their complaint before it's submitted. The new rules, as a result of the law and procedures, have the agency not responding to inquiries. Instead, it's from the public and assisting them with filing complaints. Instead, the complainants are steered to attorneys or to back to the broker to resolve it with the broker. The grounds for discipline have been watered down substantially. The commissioner must now consider quite a long list of circumstances, including whether or not the licensee was cooperative. The highest level sanction that it can result in is a reprimand, and revocation occurs in only the very narrowest of circumstances. I think the impact has been that there are much fewer complaints opened. The hands of investigators have been tied, and the number of complaints is falling off because complainants are discouraged. The agency opposed House Bill 2604, and we were audited. The agency was given an 18-month budget, and the task force was formed. The task force representation was in my opinion, the public members were very heavily dominated by the industry. The co-chair, Representative Esquivel, is a broker, and the public members included OAR board members, the OAR president, and a member of the of the board who is a real estate attorney and the commissioner who's a broker. I'm unaware of any consumer groups who are represented in the task force deliberations. And as the Senate Bill 324, as written, gives extensive control to the board, including investigations, an extensive role in investigations and discipline. And in my opinion, the pendulum has swung way too far in the direction of control by the industry. A home is the single largest investment that Oregonians will make, and examples of harm to consumers by licensees are self-dealing, buyers losing their home to foreclosure, loan fraud, theft of trust accounts, false advertising, and misrepresentation. And I think that consumers need your protection, and I would urge you to get the pendulum to swing back in the other direction. And my recommendations would be to leave the board as advisory. If it becomes policy setting, limit its powers to policy oversight, not involvement in agency operations. At the same time, prohibit the director or commissioner from being a broker. If you have a board and a director who are brokers, and 7 of the 9 members brokers, and only 2 public members, I think it gives the industry too much control.
Mr. Reynolds, I'm going to stop you there. First of all, I've actually read through your testimony, too, and I've listened to you. I really do appreciate your stuff. You brought up some very, very valid points, and we will look at that. And what I'd ask you to do, because you do have a background that is that the committee needs to take seriously because of your experience in this, working with different agencies, is as we get our amendments, I would ask that you take a look at those and we'll see what actually is being proposed at that point. But I think some of the parameters that you have established here are important ones, and we will look at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Senators. I'm Jeff Seymour. I'm an attorney in private practice. I'm a sole practitioner up in Lake Oswego. I specialize in real estate, land use, and small business law. I have just a very cursory understanding of Senate Bill 324. I've looked at House Bill 2604 and the effects of that in terms of talking towards the policy of shifting a lot of the agency control from the commissioner to the board, who then can push it on down to an appointed director. I think this is really bad policy and shouldn't happen. Right now, from my perspective, I have a number of clients I've talked to that feel the real estate agency right now is uncaring, it's powerless, it's inept. Any changes that will further weaken the regulatory scheme, whether substantively or procedurally, will render the agency's enforcement powers virtually meaningless. 2 cases real quickly I just want to go through to kind of let you know where this is coming from. 1, I represented a seller that had taken earnest money on a piece of property that is a foreigner, basic language skills. The real estate broker, in filling out, they made them fill out a residential property disclosure statement, which was not required. And the real estate broker was filling out the form, and she said, "Is there any fill on this property?" And he says, "I don't know. I don't think so." She checks the no box. The buyers rely on that. They go out and release the $70,000 earnest money to my client. They then begin testing of the property for their subdivision approvals, and they discover up to 18 feet of construction debris fill. The buyers demanded $90,000 back. It ended up costing my client $35,000. The 2 brokers were at the mediation, and both of them stated there's no difference between no and unknown on the property disclosure form. In fact, as a matter of law, they were wrong, and the no difference they claimed cost my client $35,000. In going through this procedure, my client was extremely frustrated. We finally settled it, and near the end he said, "Well, I'm going to file a complaint with the Real Estate Commission." I didn't encourage him. I didn't dissuade him. And then he finally said, "I'm not going to file a complaint." He says, "The agency won't believe me. They'll take the broker's side. They won't do anything. In the end, I'll be just throwing away more money chasing this down." This is the case where the reputation of the agency has led to the decision not to file a valid complaint. In the latest case I did that we just settled a week and a half ago, a mediation, we had 1 broker that was representing a seller. They were helping that seller buy a house. The broker was representing my clients and selling their house, and they were helping my clients buy the seller's house. basically what the broker did 2 days before the deal was supposed to close was went to my client and demanded that they terminate their purchase of this house because there's no way they could meet their contingencies in 2 days. Within 2 hours of that, this same broker was over buying the house for himself. The next day, he went to my clients with a full price offer for their house, and when they said, great, let's get in and buy the house that we've been talking about, the broker said, I'm sorry, I just bought the house last night. That's too bad. I don't care about you, and if you want to buy it, I'll sell it to you for $45,000 more than I paid for it. And those facts are not in dispute. They came out. Within 2 or 3 days of that, my clients, they were before my clients, they were still unrepresented. They filed a very detailed, clear report with the real estate agency detailing this. The response from the real estate agency was, I'm sorry, we're not going to do anything about this. Go find a lawyer. This was one of the most, and that's when they came to see me after a couple months of just not being able to take this injustice anymore. They came to see me. This was one of the most egregious real estate problems I've seen, and the agency chose to do nothing about it. If you look at the board historically, and there's a comment from either the senator or the representative, that it will take and put great expertise, broad expertise on the board. Historically, the board is made up of brokers, and by giving the brokers that are going to form the board this much power over the agency, you're going to further weaken the ability to protect the consumers. Again, I oppose Senate Bill 324. It should be defeated. We don't need this kind of law. We don't need this kind of policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Seymour. Is the mediation that you were just recently involved in, is that
yes,
public
sir.
Record?
No, sir, it's not. One of them was a lawsuit that was filed, and the documents in the lawsuit are public record. The results of the mediation themselves is a settlement that is confidential, so I can't.
And on that same issue, you said there was an appeal to the agency, the commission?
Sir, there initially was a within 2 or 3 days of this, about a year ago, there was a letter complaint filed by previous to them being my clients. They filed it with the real estate agency.
Okay, so that would be public record, too?
I believe it would be. It should be with the agency. Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir, thank you.
I will check into that. Hold on. You're not leaving yet, Ms. Reynolds. Yeah. We might get more time than you thought. We have questions from Senator Starr.
Just one for Mr. Seymour. In the last instance that you mentioned, you don't tell us what the real estate agency did, other than they said they would do nothing. Was that comment back in writing? Did they respond to your clients in writing that they weren't? I mean, based on what did they say we weren't going to do anything about it? And you have to contact.
My understanding was that my clients were called the real estate agency sometime later after they'd submitted it, wondering what was happened, and they eventually got a verbal response over the phone saying, yeah, this is a great story, kind of, but we're not going to do anything about it.
So there was no written response back from the real estate agency to your clients?
There's not. I will check with them. My understanding was that there was no written response.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Would have loved to have heard some of this testimony when we were in that work group this last summer.
Yeah. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's ask Rick Harris and John Zupan to come forward. They've traveled more than 100 miles. They're signed up in support.
I'm John Zupan. I'm a real estate broker in Medford, Oregon. I'm also a board member for the agency board. And I don't really have a prepared testimony. I just wanted to make a couple comments as to the board. The way the board works right now, it's really a worthless board. We've gotten more involved since this bill started coming about and so forth because the commissioner has gotten us more involved. About 3 years ago, I was ready to resign because I figure I'm wasting my time, I'm wasting the agency's money and time driving to Salem for a half an hour meeting every other month, and we never even see the budget or anything else. Our position is, as a board member, we don't want to micromanage, but we do feel that we need to set some type of policy, some type of an oversight. Otherwise, the agency just becomes a bureaucracy, and there's no connection with the industry or the public. We've heard testimony today about how if the industry gets involved, it's going to hurt the public, which I don't agree with. most of, I've been in the business since 1972, and I found probably the hardest people on other members of the real estate community when they're doing something wrong are the ethical members of the real estate community. We don't want those people in our the stories you heard. We don't want those people in our industry. It's not good for us. It's not good for the public. It's not good for the real estate industry. I think, unless you have some questions, that'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Zubin. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. My name is Rick Harris. I'm a real estate broker in Ashland. I chaired the Real Estate Agency Task Force on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I've been involved in this issue for 3.5 years specifically. A couple of things that I wanted to point out to you. Senator George asked a very pertinent question. What's the philosophy? And the philosophy about how to regulate an industry is to educate them. You heard from the former deputy at the agency. You heard from an attorney. Those are indications of what's the matter with the real estate agency right now. The way that the work has been done in the past has got us to this point of needing to have an industry regulated by a set of rules from people who understand it, not to get anyone off the hook, but to actually understand what industry is being regulated. And I would argue, based on what's the history of this agency, that they don't know. They don't know what the business is. Take, for example, that none of the current investigators for the real estate agency have real estate experience. None. Now, the argument is that the real estate commissioner can solve that problem having 5 years as a broker background. But also, that commissioner has to stay separate from that investigatory process because he signs final orders and has to make sure that he's not in a position, and I say he because that's the most recent history, but he has to stay separate from that because he has to sign that final order and can't be seen as having a conflict of interest. A couple of important pieces. If you want a well-regulated industry, it must be primarily, as most of the other industries regulated in this state, by people who have direct experience. Architects, landscape designers, medical doctors, nurses are all regulated by people in the industry. I would argue as well that you want to get correct information. I would urge you to read House Bill 2604 as it was passed. It was terribly mischaracterized in earlier testimony, and I'm sorry to have to say that, but that is the case. What that bill essentially did was make regulation of a type that could be understood, easily and readily enforced, and gave people a goal that they could lead to. The challenge right now is the education system and the accountability. We have an agency that has not been truly accountable. And this regulatory board, putting the board as the policy setting, will help to make it accountable so that, yes, for consumers primarily and secondarily for the industry, you have people that are well-educated, competent, and know and understand how to deal with the regulation put before them. A couple of more important pieces there. It was pointed out that a policy-setting board would run wild. In fact, the governor appoints those people. They serve at the pleasure of the governor. So the governor would have correct oversight of those people. Consumer protection, as I pointed out, most highly important to have a well-educated industry. The agency in the past has taken the approach of wait to see what happens, beat them with a stick when they make a mistake. Wouldn't it be better for the consumer, for the industry to understand what the rules are, have them easily understood, and then regulated in such a way that's fair and direct and consistent? And we've not had that in the past. A final point to make. There's a piece of the bill that isn't on the table at this point, but we had an internal discussion at our association about, and it's important for you to know, and that's the publishing power of the agency. Right now, under current law, the agency has the ability to publish such documents as are appropriate to educate the members. That piece may, in fact, not end up in the final bill, and it really needs to be there because there are several highly important educational tools that the agency has. The manual, the blue book, the how-to, the forms that allow you to take fingerprint application and send it to the federal government, the ability to publish documents that, like the Oregon Real Estate News Journal, that tells us what the important topics of the day are, and also those issues where people have been regulated and had discipline, so that we understand what the rules are and how to enforce or how to follow them. So I would argue that your task is to stay focused on the real issues. We want a well-regulated industry. We believe the way to get there is to have a board of our peers and of consumers talking about the issues that are important, the current issues that are important, and to have those on the table in terms of appropriate policy, appropriate rules, appropriate legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of these folks? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to ask Jill Meyer. Signed up as neutral. I'm going to ask Jill Meyer to come forward. And Art Kegler didn't sign up for any particular position.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Did you want me forward now?
Yes. Welcome.
Hello there. My name is Jill Meyer, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Escrow Council. We are a professional organization that's made up of escrow professionals throughout the state of Oregon. We have been involved with the agency as far the agency does regulate the escrow industry as well as the real estate agents, and we feel that if Senate Bill 324 should pass, we would like to ask that you consider the makeup of the board and adding a representative from the escrow industry as a member of the real estate board. If they will be a policy-making body, they will be considering policy for the escrow industry as well as the real estate industry. And I believe Senator Esquivel said it best when he said no one really understands this industry unless you work in it. The same can be said for the escrow industry. And if the real estate board will be making policy for the escrow industry, we feel that there should be representation from the industry on the board.
Thank you for that observation, Ms. Meyer. Yes, sir.
Chair Metzger and committee members, I'm Art Kegler out of Boardman, Oregon, and serve on the board of directors of the agency, and I also served on the task force, the interim legislative task force with Senator Johnson and Representative Esquivel. Very briefly, and I know you're on that timeline and such, very briefly, the governor should and is in the bill to appoint the members of the board. The board should then have a position in working with the director or the commissioner, whatever you call the position that runs the day-to-day activities of the agency. The reason that I say that structure is correct is because in the past you have had a single person that had a total power related to any portions of the industry. That individual serving for some period of time loses contact. A board that is appointed by the governor and rotated would continue to have the protection of the consumer and do the best things for the industry. And I think it's very important that you keep that structure in order as to the governor with the board and the board with the director. And it's important to have that. The single commissioner that had no responsibility to anyone except the governor, and the governor is not going to sit and try to administer what the agency is to do. So I think it's very important, and I want to stress that point, that you do have a board of directors that sets policy for the agency and at the same time will direct the commissioner or director, whatever you wish to call that position. And Senator Starr, it's good to see you there. He served also on this interim task force, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. But the board has since changed its position after the DAS report came out. and the board has, I'm on the board as I mentioned, and the agency has changed, and they're funneling a lot more information to the board, but remember the board is still advisory, and not necessarily does it have to be taken seriously. I think that needs to be changed in our industry so that we have better representation from the members of the industry and also good representation from the public. That is necessary, and I think the governor can see to that. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you very much. Questions for Senator George?
Thank you. Thank you very much for serving the committee. I guess as the group went through, the question I was trying to get at earlier, Senator Johnson sort of answered it. And concern always is in these situations is where does the public have the most influence over an agency? And the testimony we heard about the problems we have with either inept or unethical brokers, those kind of things. I'm trying to figure out where do we engage the public. And it seems like to me that where we engage the public would be a board with more power, so you'd have more voices in there. And I want to kind of, if you could, just kind of tell me, and we're getting conflicting information, but I think we're trying to get at the same point. How does the public have more impact on this if they've got a problem with the agency or if they've got a problem with a specific broker or licensee? And tell me, from your perspective, do you think that making the board with more policy authority gives the public more authority or less authority? I mean, I guess I'm sort of asking a philosophical question here, but give me your input if you would.
Senator Messer, Chair, and Senator George, I feel that the change will give the public more representation and a greater opportunity. At the present time, you have to realize that there is one person that makes the decisions relative to policy addressing the public. If you have a board, and it was recommended by the task force to have a board of 7 from the industry, 2 from the two public members, and you must remember that the governor always has the opportunity to keep the board intact or to make any changes there. That's to me a very important thing, that the members on the board from the industry have the concern of the general public. I've been in real estate for 17 years. Been very active in the association in the past, and now on the board of the agency. And I will say that all of the folks that I have basically worked with that are leadership in the industry are very consumer oriented. I can't think of anyone who is trying to promote something that is not to the benefit of the consumers. And I feel that if you give the authority to a larger segment of people, i.e. the 9 members of the board versus the 1 individual commissioner that you now have, I think you're getting better representation for the consumer.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. And Mr. Hamilton and Ms. Jarvis, but I know if it's okay with you, we will be discussing this further when we get the amendment. So, and they both had, for the record, signed up in support of. Mr. Hamilton, though, noticed that you had written testimony. I would ask, where is Mr. Hamilton? If you would submit that now, that would be helpful. We'll have that in the record prior to that, and that would be really good. So we're waiting to get new amendments, and same thing with no written testimony from Laura Etherton. But if you could also, since you're in the building, wait when we get the amendments, and we'll be sure to hear from you at that time. So with that, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 324, awaiting further information.
There's a lot of people here would like to speak to this bill.
Well, sir, everybody who signed up, except for the 2-3 I mentioned, have spoken. And the hearing is now closed on this bill until we get the amendments.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry, sir. You'll have to wait till next time until we get amendments so we know what exactly we're going to talk about. We've got other bills that we need to get to today.
We had Mr. Harris and Mr. Kegler filibuster this hearing. I don't think that's right, but I'd like to make an objection.
Okay.
Well,
you may have signed up on the wrong sheet. But anyway, the hearing is now closed on this bill until the next time. If you want to be sure to sign up for the next time, we'll hear from you then. So, we're going to move ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2449A.
Who cares?
Sir?
Really?
Solar Ice Age.
Have you opened the hearing?
Yeah, I'm waiting for Janet so I can see who I got here.
So we recommend that people post that they'll get the chance to testify.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was the opposition?
Okay, Janet, you want to explain this bill? 2449.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No,
House Bill 2449 designates the Columbia Gorge Discovery Center as the Oregon Ice Age Museum. The center is developing an Ice Age exhibition that's slated to open this fall, and proponents assert that designation of the Discovery Center as the Ice Age Museum will assist the center in attracting further funding. And Representative Dellum is the sponsor of the bill, and he has the dash A two amendments that are at your places. And those amendments add an activity of the Columbia Gorge Discovery Center that would coordinate activities with the Museum of the Oregon Territory that's in Oregon City that pertain to the Ice Age. You also have a memorandum of understanding or agreement with as to the Ice Age Museum at your place today.
Thank you. Representative Dellum, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. House Bill 2449 comes to you with a little history, and I'm going to explain it. Well, it comes to you with a lot of history, 15,000 years.
Well, let's not go back to the Ice Age, because we do have other bills today, too, Representative Dellum.
Yes. We sent this bill to you out of the House, amended, and there was some cleanup done over there with the Park Service. But late in the game, another organization asked if they might be part of this process, and they wanted to share in the responsibility, all the things that being designated a part of the Ice Age Museum piece would give them. We promised to review that and send it over to the Senate. In the meantime, the Dash 2 amendments were drafted, and they're in front of you, and that's what the Dash 2 amendments did. The other group still had some concern, so we had published drafted a memorandum of understanding. The memorandum of understanding was to ensure that we had two partners of equal standing that would share in money, publicity, advertising, everything. Then about 3 weeks ago, the Dash 3 amendments came out. And with the Dash 3 amendments, I was unaware that they were being drafted. And they change the essence of the bill. I visited with my colleagues on both sides of this building and talked about the Dash 3s. And we came to the conclusion that the Dash 3s would significantly alter the bill. After consultation, I came back to Senator Metzger's office and explained to him that the Dash 3s would significantly change the meaning of the bill, and that I had made peace and everybody was happy with him. And at 11 o'clock this afternoon, I was told that the Dash 3s were back on the table. And if I don't appear rattled as I'm giving you this testimony, I am. I did not know that I had any problem with the Dash 3s. I would ask that you pass 2449 with the Dash 2 amendment, and I will ensure you that those that want to be part of the process will be part of the process. I think the memorandum of understanding takes care of that. I think the Dash 2 amendment takes care of that. I think the Dash 3 changes significantly the meaning of the bill, changes us from the museum to a museum. And with that, I would ask you to pass House Bill 2449 up to the Dash 2 amendments. I have with me a friend and a person that I have admired for a long time. I taught Western history generally and Montana history specifically. And the gentleman to my right went looking for the Lewis and Clark campsite on the Missouri River at the Great Falls. He's also looked for their campsite here in Oregon at the Dalles. And Ken knows nothing of the Dash 3 amendment, so he's here to tell you what a wonderful thing House Bill 2449 is. And with that, I'll leave it to Ken.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I will keep it short. Basically, what we are trying to do is position Oregon in terms of a national trail that is being created. In front of the 110th U.S. Congress, there are two identical bills, Senate Bill 268 and House Bill 450. And those, the purpose of those are to designate an Ice Age Flood National Geologic Trail. Behind that, the sponsor is Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington, and Senator Wyden and Senator Gordon Smith are also on that bill. Representative Doc Hastings from Washington is a sponsor in the House. Greg Walden, David Wu, Representative Blumenauer, Peter DeFazio, and Darlene Cooley are also on at sponsors, co-sponsoring that in the Senate. I think that the real point is that in 2001, the National Park Service conducted a study. I have that study right here. And what they essentially concluded in that study is that there are five major interpretive sites along the trail. And of the five major interpretive sites that have the potential to be developed, two are in existence right now in terms of interpretive centers. One is the Discovery Center. It's the only one that's identified as one of the five major sites in Oregon. It also mentions seven other significant sites in Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. And of the five other, there are two existing facilities. One is in Washington, and what they're also saying, Crown Point in Oregon would be one of these other significant sites. The thing that I think is really important is that the Ice Age Trail will be managed by the National Park Service. The bill that is in front of the U.S. Congress has an authorization for appropriation of $12 million to be used on this Ice Age Trail. And I think that it's important to recognize that $12 million is a very small sum. The Columbia Gorge Discovery Center is a $21.5 million facility. That's what it takes to build a museum. And I think that if we think in terms of an Ice Age Trail and building a number of new facilities, that is really going to dilute the effort. And right now we have that problem, for instance, with the recently ended Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. That ended last year, 2006, and already new interpretive centers that were built and opened during the bicentennial are struggling. And I understand that struggle because when the Discovery Center was created, it was created as a Forest Service interpretive center for the scenic area. The Forest Service never showed up, which means that they are about $9 million in default. How that matters to this is that as we concentrate our effort, as we look at the Ice Age Trail and that $2 million, we can use that money to good effect at a place that already has a $21.5 million facility, already has the infrastructure, and has had a 10-year track record of showing exhibits. Otherwise, I think that $12 million is not going to go very far. And that's really what my concern is that the facilities that are already available, Crown Point, the Discovery Center, other facilities that are already available are really the focus of Oregon's effort, and that's our purpose here.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. What I'm going to do is ask your colleague, Representative Bruin, to come up forward now, who has the dash three, so we can kind of get the lay of the land here. And then we have a few people signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I'm Scott Bruin. I represent House District 37, which is primarily Westland and Tualatin. More Ice Age stuff than you thought you'd ever hear in a single session, I'm sure, Mr. Chair. I don't have it in front of me. I'd sent you a note prior earlier, though, regarding the Dash 3 amendments and how some of the people that I represent, and especially in the Westland and Clackamas County area, are very concerned about House Bill 2449, its current form, without the Dash 3 amendments. A lot of issues that have been distilled down to one specific point, and I know I'm going to offend my good friend here, but I have to do it. He knows it's not personal. it's the question of calling it the Ice Age Museum rather than an Ice Age Museum, and the, there's a larger constituency than just the Dowells that are very motivated behind behind some of the benefits of the Ice Age, looking at the broader areas of the Ice Age, looking at the potential economic benefits that it brings, the historical benefits that it brings, the tool for education that it brings. Particular interest in my district, and we've talked about it before, is the meteorite that was swept down, the Willamette meteorite that was swept down, landed somewhere, you know, whether it was Washington or Canada, swept down, ended in West Lynn. So that's why my particular district has an acute interest in this. But because of that, that's why the people I represent on this particular issue are very, very passionate about having it be in Ice Age Museum rather than the Ice Age Museum. They own Clackamas County museum. I can't think of the name of it right now, but they're interested in having some of the Ice Age stature too, if you will. So,
okay, Senator George.
Thank you. I don't know, Mr. Chair, where you're going to go with this, but it seems like to me that, and I, we're talking about this, is that whatever, if we allow it to be open to more people to access the dollars, I understand we dilute the funds. But at the same time, it seems like to me there will be a process at the federal level to get those dollars, and they'll make those determinations. So if somebody else doesn't deserve those Ice Age dollars, or they won't use them as much or as efficiently, then you folks would be the winner of that grant. You see what I'm saying? So I'm trying to figure out why we'd be opposed. If your museum is the best one, or your location, the Dalles, is the best place to go with this, it seems like to me that you'd win in the grant writing process regardless of how we wrote this bill. But it also allow other people who have legitimate interest to go to the federal government and ask for those dollars. If you could just discuss that for me, I'd appreciate it.
I think right now we have one museum and one group of people that are very interested in being identified as involved with the Ice Age Museum. If you look at the Memorandum of Understanding, we would share everything, the money, the publicity. If there's anything to be gained by being an Ice Age facility, up to the Dash 2s, we'll get all of those that have been identified as wanting to be part of the process in the process. If we have, along the trail, 19 other spots with some significance, and we say, and, we are not going to divide whatever money there is by the number of people that come forward as time runs on. We have now identified two, and we have no problem sharing with the good people from Mr. Bruin's area anything, any advantage that might be gained from being declared an Ice Age Center. It's the unknown number, and there are a lot. The Ice Age backwater all the way up to Eugene completely changed the surface features of the gorge. So we have roughly a third of our state involved, and the number of places involved that could step forward with an and is unknown. The number of places that can step forward with the and a memorandum of understanding with the other party is two. And thus we don't dilute the quality of our exposition. We don't dilute the quantity. What we do is say the Ice Age will primarily be featured in these two places. And others, if they have merit, I'm sure these two places would consider them, but this gives us some control of how many people we're talking about.
Senator Starr, you had a question?
Yeah, for Representative Byrne, the museum in Clackamas County is at the end of the Oregon Trail Museum. Is
correct.
That what you're considering?
Yeah, is that
both the end of the Oregon Trail and the Museum of the Oregon Territory are under one.
All right, you have to come forward. You went past two words. So two words means you have to get back up here and tell us who you are. Yeah. So if we can make room for this gentleman. Who are you, sir? Are you on my list?
Yes.
Well, that'll be helpful. We'll save time. So if you identify yourself, answer the question. And
thank you, Senator Metzger, Senator Starr. I'm David Porter. I'm the Executive Director of Clackamas Heritage Partners. We operate the End of the Oregon Trail Interpretive Center, Museum of the Oregon Territory, Stevens Crawford Heritage House in Oregon City. Museum of the Oregon Territory is the facility that's named in this particular instance because since the 1980s it has had exhibits on the Ice Age floods, which there are many evidences of in historic Oregon City, West Lynn area. My colleague Mark Buser who is the chair of the West Lynn chapter of the Ice Age Floods Institute, has been working on this federal legislation for 5 years. Oregon City West Lynn is the other area that actually is named in the study as being a site for interpretation, although at the time of the study in the early 90s, it was not clear what place would go there.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, it seems to me that what we have is a fight over a potential $12 million in federal funding. Is that the deal?
At least partial of that $12 million.
Part of it.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me, Mr. Porter, where is that?
The Museum of the Oregon Territory?
Yeah.
Museum of the Oregon Territory is sited right overlooking Willamette Falls in Oregon City, at the south end of Oregon City. It has several thousand square feet of exhibit space, part of which is dedicated to the Ice Age floods, including having a chunk of the Willamette meteorite, which is one of our items in our collection.
Okay. So I'm just trying to get help me with this, Representative Bruin, but that's not your district, right? The Oregon City part? Or
no, it's not.
No.
Okay.
Dave Hunt's district.
So, okay. You just mentioned people in your district. So, I mean, it's just kind of like the community at large as opposed to the actual site.
Well, not the site of the museum, but the one of the gentlemen I represent, Mark Buser, and it's the I'm going to get the name wrong. It's the West Lynn.
The Lower Columbia Floods Chapter.
Lower Columbia Floods Chapter, which is actually centered in West Lynn. Thank you. That's the roundabout way to how we get to my district.
Okay, I'm just trying to get this clear because Mr. Buser has signed up in support of this bill, so I got it. I'm trying to get this all settled up. So just so I can expedite things, I want you guys to step back. Mr. Porter, you might stay there. Let's ask Mr. Buser to come forward and Joan O'Leary. That is everybody that I have signed up on this bill. Huh?
Probably the guy.
Oh, John.
No, I think that's the realist.
Oh, John O'Leary.
Up on the wrong.
Oh, that's probably the guy I heard from earlier. Okay. He really wanted to talk about the Ice Age Museum. All right. All right. These things happen. Okay, so, Mr. Buser, could you tell us who you are for the record and then explain to me this little dispute here. How do we solve it?
Good afternoon, Senator Metzger and the committee members. I am Mark Buser. I am in several roles. Primarily for today, I'm here as the founding president of the Lower Columbia Floods Chapter of the Ice Age Floods Institute. I'm also a board member of the Ice Age Floods Institute. Just for the record, to make sure you all understand, it was this group that created the legislation that was introduced by Maria Cantwell from the state of Washington and from Representative Doc Hastings. Also from the state of Washington in the House. It's also noteworthy that I'm the president of the West Lynn Chamber of Commerce. West Lynn views the Ice Age Floods Trail and has viewed it for the previous 5 years as having some economic development potential and benefit in our region. My affiliation with the Ice Age Floods Institute has been over the really the 3 years. I formed the chapter, then became a board member. And in that opportunity, working with folks across four states, I've been able to become one of the key advocates of establishing legislation for the trail. As was mentioned by Ken Karmiski, we have a full delegation from Oregon on board to pass that legislation. I think that what you need to understand is that we have not even passed these bills yet. These bills were reintroduced in January. The Senate fast-tracked their bill. It's in committee. It's being held up with some other bills. So these bills are going to pass. It looks that way. We've been telling stakeholders for 5 years that it's going to pass, and now it really does look like it. The $12 million, of course, would be a separate appropriations process. And I think that the idea that there's going to be all this money available for existing interpretive facilities in Oregon is a little bit far-fetched, in that $12 million has to basically pay for the establishment of the National Park Service infrastructure to manage the trail. I would argue that the funding that's going to happen to build this trail out is going to come from the from local groups. It's a grassroots effort. In West Lynn, I've collaborated with Oregon City. I've brought them on board. I have established that the Ice Age floods are a key layer of the settlement of the West Story, and that the sediments of the Willamette Valley created the fertility, the agricultural fertility that we see today. The aggregate industry has benefited from the Missoula floods. There's very much a relevant story, a Westland Oregon City story.
Right, so let me just kind of cut to the chase if I can here a little bit. Based on the expertise that you've clearly articulated, so what is the primary difference between naming the Columbia Gorge Center as the Ice Age Museum, but will work with the museum in Westland, or to name it as a Ice Age Museum, designating it thusly, and it doesn't seem to be like it could not, it could still compete with others in partnership for any type of grant. What is the major deal here?
From an institutional perspective, I think that it's clear that designation as the officially recognized state anything gives an organization special place, special standing, and because there are other places where that story and those issues are as significant and deserve to be told equally, it seems to be inappropriate to foreclose that option by naming one place as the Oregon Ice Age Museum. The part that goes with that is that Mark's study, the federal study, did say, and the federal legislation reflects this, that there would be two sites in Oregon. So because those were both called out, it seems strange to foreclose that option at this juncture.
So you would seem to be more in support of the Dash 3 amendment.
Absolutely.
And what about you, sir?
Yes, both the A2 and A3 amendment would make the bill, I think, relevant and the best bill that could be passed. Now, Senator George, I just wanted to reiterate your words. You were exactly right in your comments regarding the fact that why not let multiple organizations compete for grants and let the grant money go to the deserving organization. And I will add to that as we all know, there's this idea that there's a limited amount of money. And since there's a limited amount of money, designate one place for it to go, when actually what we're finding in communities is that you get a community excited about a project, and then you have investors. Westland, I have raised $125,000 through my efforts to develop an interpretive trail in Fields Bridge Park. I'll tell you right now that if we name the Discovery Center as the Oregon Ice Age Museum, I'm going to feel, less than motivated to go out and find more money. In other words, these stories cross four states. They cross multiple regions. This is about inclusivity. I think that the spirit of the trail is that there's multiple organizations participating. If six museums come forward and want to be Oregon Ice Age Museums, I don't see a problem with that, because what hasn't been talked about is that it's the people that are going to visit, it's the public that's going to come to these museums that's going to help from the economic development standpoint. And the better we can coordinate and promote and market the trail, the more visitors for everybody, the bigger the pie, the bigger piece everybody gets. That's
okay.
Just one quick question.
Yes, Senator Starr.
We don't pass this bill. Does Oregon not have the opportunity to get money for whatever museums or...
Clarify. The Lower Columbia Floods chapter, as being a chapter of the Ice Age Floods Institute, and as the Ice Age Floods Institute being the official advisor to the federal government and the National Park Service, they will actually come to the Lower Columbia Floods chapter, that organization that I founded, to discuss the process for establishing the trail here. So the answer to that question is that if you don't pass the bill, no, that will not affect our piece of the pie. I would say, though, that I want to see the bill pass. I don't want to be seen as blocking progress towards the establishment of the trail. And so I'm torn.
Okay. Well, I think we are too. So what I'm going to do is we're going to not going to move this bill today. I will wait until Representative Bruin and Representative Dowling can be back to me holding hands, and then if that happens, we will bring the bill back, and otherwise, the Ice Age lasted a long time, the bill can last a few more days. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2449A. Mr. Kushner, you can stay there. We're going to open up a public hearing on HJM 6. Janet.
Mr. Chair, HJM 6. Came out of the House on a unanimous vote, and it urges Congress to support the establishment of the Ice Age Floods National Geologic Trail Representative Bruin is a sponsor. Representative Bruin has a dash one amendment that's at your place that would clarify that the name of the study that recommended the establishment of the trail by Congress, and it adds a whereas that's regarding the finding of the Willamette meteorite near West Lynn in 1902. You'll note it doesn't say anything about the current location of the Willamette meteorite.
Thank heaven.
We don't have to get into that controversy. That's all I have.
Okay. Mr. Buser, welcome again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay. Maybe this will be easier, huh?
This one's a lot easier.
Okay.
Yes. This one is kind of fun, actually. I was amused by the, what was it, HJM 30 that created all the conflict, but this basically is a joint memorial. It was one that was passed by Washington State several years ago in support of establishing the Ice Age Floods Trail. We used the same language when it was introduced. The amendment basically updates the bill and references one of Oregon's most unique connections to the Ice Age Floods, which is the Willamette meteorite and its journey here on top of an iceberg.
Thank you. Any questions about the memorial? Okay. Thank you. Think hard about who would like to carry this bill. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on HJM 6.
Move the dash one amendment to HJM 6.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendment to HJM 6. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I move the memorial be adopted and sent to the Senate floor to do that recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved the adoption of House Joint Memorial 6 as amended and be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I just want to say on House Joint Memorial 6, it's nicer to have a bill that doesn't have so much divisive nature over global warming as the earlier bill did. So, appreciate that.
Yeah, things were warming up. Okay, any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry HJM 6 and earn a spot in the Weekly Democrat? Hey, Senator Modest Anderson, you're close, to the gorge area as well, so where the water all started coming. So Senator Modest Anderson will carry. Thank you very much. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 492. Boxing and wrestling is back. Janet, hopefully.
Chair, I was not going to suggest cage fighting to Representative Bruin and Representative Dolan.
It might be one way. Dueling is still in the Constitution. Except you have to go out of state. You know that? So, we digress. Go ahead.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 492, and we have I'm going to pass these out.
Okay.
The second page was not copied on the amendments in your packet.
It's on front and back, sir.
So, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 492 is the mixed martial arts creation of the changing the name of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to the Oregon State Athletic Commission. Thank you. We had the dash four amendments, and the discussion at the last meeting on this measure was related to the definition to make sure to exclude some martial arts so that the commission wouldn't be bringing in fighting that's not considered mixed martial arts. Brad Darcy's here from the agency.
Mr. Darcy, come forward and see if we've got this yet.
And you can see the lines 4 through 6 of the amendment.
Welcome, Mr. Darcy.
Thank you.
Okay, we had talked about in our last meeting the concerns about not bringing in general competitive issues that around this general sport topic that were not intended to be regulated by your industry, and so the dash five is to represent hopefully that, so we can kind of speak to that and how our definitions have been put together, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity today. Yes, that's correct. In our last work session, we were asked to clarify the definition of mixed martial arts. The concern raised by the committee was that our definition might be broad enough to include sports or activities the Boxing and Wrestling Commission did not intend to regulate or control. The Boxing and Wrestling Commission's intent is to acquire the authority to regulate the sport commonly known as and defined in this bill as mixed martial arts. This sport is referred to also as cage fighting and ultimate fighting. It's not the commission's intent to broaden our regulatory authority to include sports that do not meet our definition of mixed martial arts. Senate Bill 492's revised definition of mixed martial arts is, quote, mixed martial arts means a combative sporting contest, the rules of which allow two mixed martial arts competitors to attempt to achieve dominance over one another by utilizing a variety of techniques, including but not limited to striking, grappling, and the application of submission holds. Mixed martial arts does not include martial arts such as taekwondo, karate, kempo karate, judo, sumo, jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, submission wrestling, or kung fu. A defining feature of mixed martial arts is the intent of the competitor to render an opponent unable to continue the contest. Classic styles of martial arts, like the ones excluded in our definition, are now excluded, generally do not include this intent. I will also note for the record that that the first of the Dash 5 amendments inserts the phrase, quote, the rules of which allow, end quote. The commission, if this bill is passed, would promulgate rules governing the conduct of mixed martial arts competitions. Those rules would include health standards like, for example, the requirement that competitors would be tested during a physical examination for bloodborne pathogens like HIV or hepatitis. I want to thank the committee administrator Janet Adkins and Legislative Counsel's Office Attorney Charlie Cheek for their help and guidance on this bill. I thank the committee for your time and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Darcy. Senator Starr, I know you're the one who brought this particular issue up. So.
Yeah, I think that from my perspective, that kind of clarifies the issues that this new commission is going to regulate, not regulate. So,
other questions for Mr. Carsey? Okay, we are in work session then.
I move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 492.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 492. Other discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard.
So, Mr. Carsey, if I could ask you a question. So, and I'm going back to the hearing that was about a month ago. The two concerns that I had, one were the whole issue of 18 and under, and I know we get into that issue. What would be the other, and I don't think we get at it in this bill, is the other question that was put on the table of more activity for those, and I remember the clips that y'all provided of a 19-year-old that was airlifted over to Boise. How, by adopting the Dash 5 and then moving this bill, are we going to help keep situations like that from occurring far, far less frequently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckard, I appreciate the question. Basically, right now, the majority of the matches taking place are wholly unregulated. And so with the authority that this bill grants the commission, we can impose and enforce rules for safety, health, and also the conduct and rules of these particular matches to, while there's still risk, obviously, this activity, we would minimize those inherent risks by the enforcement of those rules. An example, or I could cite lots of examples of the kinds of rules we enforce, standardized rules for the competitions, medical personnel at the events, everything from pre-testing the physical fitness of the competitors. There is a spectrum of things that we impose currently on professional mixed martial arts that we would now apply to specifically that particular case you cite and others that have prompted injuries or more extreme activities that are more inherently risky than we are tolerant of or want to be tolerant of.
So, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I'm literally just on the fence of not support, because I think part of me would say, why would we allow two people to fight to what seems almost the death, or certainly looking through the clips that y'all provided were in too many occasions near-death experience, but I would rely more on you're right in the middle of regulating these folks. So maybe you could convince me that, yes, we should allow this to occur under a highly regulated environment, but allow it to occur within Oregon.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckert. My history on this, I came to this particular position with more of a boxing background. That's what I frankly thought I'd be regulating most of the time in the function of this position, and have gotten a fast crash course in what these sports entail. And it, there's a spectrum of it, and there are fringes of that spectrum that the commission has been intolerant of. We but had no tool to affect. There's also, though, a spectrum within this activity that, and it's strange I find myself saying this, but it's in a lot of ways safer than boxing. Boxing historically has had, and granted there's a longer period of time we're talking about, but in the same time that mixed martial arts has been taking place, and this is nationally, and boxing, we've had several deaths in boxing and have had no recorded deaths in mixed martial arts. I've watched hundreds of these matches, literally, and because of the nature of it, and I'd be happy to go into more detail on the actual sport, but because of the nature of it, it is inherently, in my opinion, safer actually than boxing. For the uninitiated, which I was initially, I remember my first few matches, especially the unregulated ones, my first reaction was, frankly, how do we stop this? But now that we've progressed in terms of our understanding of the sport, how to regulate it effectively, what we've tried to do is get the authority to do that, and then that's what we hope to do.
Okay. Well then, Mr. Chair, my only request would be, as we give you this expanded regulatory powers, that you really use it to help what seems to be young guys, now at least it's 18 and over, but these young guys, so they don't end up like the few that I read about, where the rest of their lives are damaged and they can't work or live normal lives, and I just ask you to use that authority to do that.
We intend to do. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Deckard. I think and I share a lot of your concerns, and I would say that I really appreciate Mr. Darcy working on this to provide some form of regulation so that not wanting to get out in the way of the good, you know, for the perfect, you know, when we have an unregulated environment now. But, you know, I share a lot of your concerns about that. Senator Montes Anderson, you have
a
question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're establishing the Athletic Commission Medical Advisory Committee, and it doesn't state in here that the health concerns are. It talks about pre- and post-fight exams and more of what's needed there at the fight, but it could be a role, and I would don't need an amendment for this, that's for sure, but it could be their role to oversee and maybe provide some guidelines for the concerns that the senator from Beaverton raised.
Yes, if I could respond. Yes, sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Montes Anderson, we have historically as a commission always relied heavily on medical personnel to provide guidance on health standards, everything from the application of drug testing to how to determine fitness to compete, what things to test for bloodborne pathogens, those kind of thing, and we're hoping that the advisory committee can actually do exactly that.
Thank you. Any other questions on the amendment? Any objections to the amendment? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 492 as amended by the dash 5 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I see it's Senator Bates's bill, so let's give him the opportunity to carry that bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Darcy.
Thank you.
All right, let's open up public work session, excuse me, on Senate Bill 1022. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1022 is the bill that would establish the Oregon Transportation Commission as the authority to approve establishment of tolls in Oregon, and it sets up process and ability for citation through electronic tolling devices. You have the dash 6 amendments that were just received today, I understand, and they do some things that the previous amendment did, and one other thing. They delete the misdemeanor provisions for toll evasion. So this bill has a subsequent referral to the Judiciary Committee, and with the deletion of that misdemeanor provision, the bill does not need to probably go to the Judiciary Committee. The amendments also specify that the measure does not prohibit cities or counties from establishing tolls on highways under their jurisdictions. And finally, the amendments add a list of issues that the commission is directed to consider in reviewing tolling proposals. So, again, Mr. Chair, it sets up the process for tolling, and it combines a number of statutes and deletes the number of statutes that are outdated.
Okay. Are you here to address the amendment? Who is here to address the amendment?
Actually, Mr. Chair, the amendment is one that I worked on.
Okay. Senator Starr.
Unfortunately, the copy that I have doesn't have the back.
We were just passed out a new one, so.
So, the language primarily is that we address is the issue. This is not it. This is 492. Senate Bill 1022, the -6 amendments. The one I have doesn't have a back.
This one does. This one has.
But it's the language. The key language really is on the back. It says nothing in ORS 383.003 to 383.027 prohibits a city or county from establishing a toll on any highway, as defined in ORS 801.305. That the city or county has jurisdiction over a road pursuant to 811. Basically, what this says is that cities and counties can toll facilities that they are in their jurisdiction. That was the issue that we were working on when this bill was back before us originally. I think this language takes care of that issue. I worked closely with cities and counties and Randy Tucker at Metro to craft this language and Legislative Council. The Department of Transportation has seen this amendment and is fine with the amendment as well.
Does anybody want to address this amendment? You do? Okay. So does everybody remember our discussion on this and the clarity in terms of what the authorities would be of the cities and then the role of the commission? And I appreciate Senator Starr's work on trying to clarify that. Anybody have any questions additionally on that?
I just have a one-sided amendment.
Yeah, well, here you go. Here. Well, that was delivered, Senator Decker. We didn't want you to see the backside.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator George.
Senator Starr, I guess my question is that if there's a conflict between the what the city wants to do or the county wants to do, and its effect on state highways, who would ultimately come out on top of that? That's some examples we talked about.
Well, what this amendment does is it doesn't have the state preempting the city or the county, and as it relates to a local facility, and so. The OTC could not basically say no, you can't toll to a city or county. What I will tell you in practice, what will occur is that you're not going to have a city or county that's going to do this without consulting the Department of Transportation. It's just not going to happen. And my concern is that we don't set up a situation where the OTC can overrule a local government. They basically tell them, no, you can't toll that facility. And that's how the original bill has been set out. So this maintains what I consider a right relationship between locals and the state. You'll have to make a judgment call whether you believe that at the end of the day they're going to work together and if there's issues on the table that they get worked out. But if you have a city or a county that's faced with a challenge to rebuild a facility and tolling is a tool that's in their toolbox, the last thing I want to do is discourage them from having full access to those tools that may be available to them.
I guess if we have a conflict, we'll get the issue again.
Yeah.
So it's probably less
handle it. Right. And I think Senator Starr is right. And in reality, as you think about it, I can't envision very many circumstances, but there's only one that I actually envision, that a local street and stuff would be considered for tolling. Not that they couldn't, but I mean, just trying to think in reality, the most reality would be bridges. You know, your city bridges are going to replace the Sellwood or something like this. That there would be some possibilities of trying to figure out that as a cost. And I think, Senator Starr, you did a great job in terms of of just making sure that cities have their maintain their right, and also with the OTC and its overall responsibility to know what's going on and be able to address the overall system. So I'm comfortable with the dash 6 if the members are.
I'd move the dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 1022.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved the dash 6 to Senate Bill 1022. Discussion? Objection? Order.
We don't need to send this to judiciary.
No, we do not now.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 1022 as amended, Senate 4 with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to judiciary be rescinded.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 1022 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Judiciary Committee be rescinded. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, Senator Starr, you can carry that bill. Okay, we're getting there. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 827. Janet.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 827 was the bill that created the Urban Growth Boundary Expansion Area Revolving Loan Fund to provide low-interest loans for infrastructure projects in areas of UGB expansion since 1997. $25 million payment from lottery revenues would fund any amounts that are necessary. You have at your place the dash 2 amendments, and they're just one page, so that's good. And they eliminate the requirement that the borrower from the fund must be a city that expanded its urban growth priority, so it allows cities and counties to borrow from the fund. And the new thing in the amendment today is that it restricts the type of revenue that may be used to repay loans from the new fund, and that's in line 7 through 12 of the amendment. Mr. Chair, this bill has a separate referral to two separate committees, the Finance and Revenue Committee and then the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I can talk to the dash 2s.
Yes.
This is an issue that I raised when we originally heard this bill about who repays the loan. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned. We've got expansion, urban growth boundary expansion in Washington County. Lots of land speculation, lots of very high prices for land. Developers concerned that their quote-unquote investments aren't going to pay off, and they, from my perspective, are looking to shift costs to other taxpayers. That concerns me. Mr. Papsdorf and I worked on this language in the subsection 6 that's on lines 7 through 12 in the amendment in order to clarify who would have to repay the loan. I'm satisfied with this language. I'm not in love with this whole idea, but I won't oppose I won't oppose it at this point, but I'm still concerned overall about urban growth boundary expansion and the cost to provide infrastructure there, and who's going to bear that cost. And from my perspective, the developers ought to bear that cost. I'll live with the language that's in this amendment, since we've worked with City of Gresham and Mr. Papsdorf.
Well, thank you, Senator Starr. And the bill does have a little journey before it would become and before it's on the floor. And fortunately, both you and Senator Deckard in Revenue will have an opportunity to work on that issue further. And I think it is important at least to have that opportunity to have that discussion, so I'd like to move it forward.
Yeah, if you would like, I could move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 827.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 827. Discussion?
Does this bill go to every committee in the Senate before?
Well, we figured it goes to the most important committee, the Revenue Committee. We know that the rest of it, I'm sure, will be a slam dunk after that. All right, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scott.
I move Senate Bill 827 as amended to the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 827 as amended by this dash 2 amendment to the Committee on Finance and Revenue with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Deckard is yours, and we are adjourned.